Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passaran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we're joined by independent journalist Laura Jadid. Laura, thanks for coming on.
It's always great to be here.
Laura, you have been gadding about the country. You've been rioting in LA. You've been parading in DC.
We had a lovely parade with all the many tanks, the big, beautiful tanks. It's quite something.
Well, what's been your favorite event of the year so far?
Honestly, and I did not expect this to be my answer 2 weeks ago, but I really enjoyed that parade, not because of what Trump wanted it to be, but because it was so resolutely not that. Speaking of the tanks, I just really enjoyed the way the people driving the tanks or the people manning the turret waved and smiled the whole time to what I have to assume is to ensure that Trump and the media could not get a single menacing picture of tanks. Every single picture you see with people in the tanks involves smiling and waving. And I find it hard to read that as anything other than resistance, because that's not, you know, military parades don't usually involve a lot of smiling or waving. And it definitely seemed on purpose, and it was definitely every single one of them.
Is it possibly a bit of a PR move, given that at some point the people in the tanks are going to be called upon to fire on their fellow citizens?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, I think that's definitely one way I've heard people read it that way. But I know that the action certainly prevented Trump or the media from getting their photo op, which I think they wanted so very badly. And I think it's the reason that Trump looked so grouchy, that and the fact that it turns out military parades are actually quite boring, which I could have told him, but now he knows.
I understand the parade had a fantastic soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. No, it was great. I actually got to see that. I was quite a bit farther up from the actual interesting DJ choices that were made. So really, I just got to hear the marching bands and then the silence, the absolute silence when there weren't bands playing, except for the squeaky tank, which I think most people have perhaps seen. It was lovely. But yeah, it was, you could hear birdsong. In one of the clips that I posted online, you can hear the birds chirping as they drive by and march by, because that is how enthused the crowd wasn't.
Fortunate Son seems like it had to have been a deliberate choice.
I have to assume. I mean, in order to sing the song, you do have to know the lyrics. And I was it really was kind of inspired, because of course, you know, people who listen to the first three lines of the song think it's patriotic. And I have to imagine sang it, who was like he's a veteran, wounded in Afghanistan, turned country singer. I feel like he knew he could sneak it past him, and he did. And it was very awesome.
Well, we do like to wave that red, white, and blue flag, you know. Doesn't get more patriotic than that.
Don't worry about the rest of it. Don't worry about it. It's fine. That was at the festival earlier in the day. Which was also not, I think, what Trump was hoping for. It was a strange, it really felt like a mix between like the lamest regional carnival you've ever been to and a business conference. There were like booths for USAA the bank and a trailer where you could play Mortal Kombat and kind of like a futuristic setting and one of those old timey things where you like hit the mallet with the lever with the hammer and it sends the weight up to hit the bell. You know, it's like that strength thing. I don't know. That was there for some reason. Food trucks with hamburgers. The Boston Dynamics dogs were there, but that was as menacing as things got. There were also a lot of empty booths, which I thought was interesting. I mean, really remarkably many. At first, I was just like, oh, they're late, but they were just empty. And I do wonder if people maybe pulled out. The whole day was really lackluster in a way that I personally appreciated very much.
Do you think this kind of not entirely successful parade reflects in any way the state of the MAGA movement?
I think it reflects the status of the MAGA movement within the military. I think that we learned some really important things, honestly. Obviously, there are elements of the military that are MAGA. We saw some of that at the horrific speech Trump gave in front of at Fort Bragg in front of my old unit, much to my absolute eternal shame, where they apparently hand-selected soldiers who were going to laugh and cheer in ways that are actually extremely against the rules for Trump's horrific BS. Let's go with that. But this parade, nobody, it really, between the smiling and waving tankers and the really lackluster marching and the fact that everything at this festival was so, like, nonpartisan is overstating it. It was just really boring, aggressively boring, and it felt on purpose. It wasn't even like a cringe attempt at being, you know, badass, which I think they do a lot. They love to try and fail. This wasn't even that. This was avoiding it, I think. And it really was encouraging to me. It shows me that I don't think America's military is ready to be Donald Trump's shock troops. At least that's what I'm walking away feeling.
Laura, you recently wrote a piece for The Nation about Pete Hegseth and why he might still be around despite a series of mishaps. What's your take on Trump's plans for Hegseth?
Oh my God. Yeah. Now my ability to not curse is really going to be put to the test. That big jerk, that absolute loser, Pete Hegseth he's about the most incompetent person you could possibly wish for, but he is also a fanatical Trump loyalist. He basically, his big claim to fame, activism wise, is going to the mat for war criminals, Eddie Gallagher and other people whose names are escaping me, people who committed atrocities, massacred civilians, you know, in cold blood. And he went to bat for them, and Trump pardoned them in his first term, largely thanks to Hegseth's lobbying. And so now Trump has somebody who, you know, he's basically destroyed military readiness in really important ways, but he's also gutted the surface of anybody who might, or he's trying to. I mean, he's doing purges of the top brass of anyone I think that they think might cause trouble with orders they don't like. He seems to be willing to use Signal to hide records from FOIA requests. He is a loyalist. And I think he understands what Trump understands, what I believe I also understand, which is that the military is not going to be super excited about an order to go in against civilians. I mean, the military is conservative, but it's conservative in the sense that it's hidebound by tradition. And traditionally in America, the military does not attack civilians. It's not a thing. Like, there have been instances, very famously, some of them, but it is unusual and it is frowned on. And I think Hegseth has pretty good job security because Trump can trust him to do his best to make the military carry out unlawful orders.
Trump has nonetheless been able to deploy the National Guard to California and elsewhere. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah. So there's a big legal battle over whether this is constitutional or not, which doesn't narrow this down because that's everything that's happening in America right now. But yeah, Trump has over the head of California Governor Gavin Newsom has mobilized California's National Guard to go into LA to control what he would really like you to believe are out of control rioters. He's also sent in 700 Marines. That one is weirdly less legally contentious, because there is some precedent for doing this. Although, again, it does depend on there being a riot, which nothing that has happened in LA has even come close to rising to that level, unless you look at the actions of the police themselves. But yeah, as of this time, I believe there are 4,000, possibly 6,000 National Guard soldiers and 700 Marines in LA. As far as I could tell, not really doing a lot. There are National Guard standing in front of buildings. The Marines detained and then released a man who was late to an appointment and took a wrong turn. But it's fairly clear, I believe, that this is a trial balloon. Trump would like to do this in more cities. He's certainly been talking about doing it in other cities. New York, Philly, Seattle's been mentioned. Chicago, of course, has been mentioned. But this also hasn't really worked out, I think, the way Trump had hoped to, because there aren't riots. So there hasn't been a lot for them to do. And they're not exactly living large. They're apparently sleeping on the floor of a convention center, eating MREs, which is not a pleasant way to live under any, you know, any situation. And I mean, National Guard guys, I don't know how familiar you are or if it's the same out there, but these are guys that signed up to drill one weekend a month because they want to go to college or they want a little extra money. They're not hardcore. These are members of their own communities. And when you sic members of their own community against other members, it usually doesn't go well. And it's not going well here either. For Trump, I feel like it's going pretty well for everyone else. But, and, you know, the fact that even the protests are getting smaller in LA, J.D. Vance just went out there to give a big rah-rah speech about how they're going to put down all this disorder. But there isn't any disorder to put down. They desperately want a pretext, I think, for martial law, but there just isn't one. And we'll see how aggressive they want to get with making stuff up with that.
Well, in terms of that pretext, you wrote recently in your excellent newsletter, bannedinyourstate.com, that Trump is desperately in need of a Reichstag fire. And one of the scenarios you proffered was that, you know, an ICE agent getting injured. You have these people ununiformed running around with guns, grabbing people off the street into unmarked vans. I would just note, even the political assassins in America at the moment are wearing uniforms. Yep. Seems only a matter of time until someone tries to grab someone off the street. People in America have guns still, right?
As far as I know.
Seems inevitable that something will happen.
No, I agree. It is unreal that there are people running around in basically army surplus gear and patches that say ICE protest. I posted on social media today, you can get an ICE police badge for $16.99 on eBay if you would like one, that you can just stick to a plate carrier that you buy at your local surplus store and then put on an ill-fitting sweatshirt and hit the streets. And you would be indistinguishable from an ICE agent. It's a recipe for disaster on so many levels. I mean, people are asking, and I would like to know also, I mean, how many of these people are imposters? CNN ran an article. They've at least caught three. We don't know who these people are. We don't know if they're all ICE. And at a certain point, it does become self-defense. And I am waiting for that to happen. And I think that's, you know, an ideal situation for them. And I'm also not sure how you get around it because, I mean, what do you do when masked men attempt to throw you in an unmarked van? I mean, best case scenario is still pretty bad. It's ICE. And worst case scenario, it's a militia and you don't know where the hell you're getting taken. So yeah, it's a really ugly, precarious position.
Laura, what's been the effect of this basically terror campaign upon communities in LA and elsewhere?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and this might be very, well, the polls back me up. I think that it is opening low information voters' eyes to what Trump really is. I mean, he's got his fanatical MAGA base. They're very loud online and they're very loud in real life too. You know, they love it. They listen to the deportation ASMR videos. They make their horrific, revolting Hayao Miyazaki pictures of ICE arresting a crying woman. We've seen this. But the polls are swinging against Trump's deportations in a big way. This is not how he sold them. To people who weren't paying a lot of attention, it sounded like he was going to round up criminals, and they're not. They're rounding up people who work at Home Depot. They're rounding up people's families, people's neighbors. And I do think that this is weirdly drawing communities together, not tearing them apart. I mean, at the No Kings protest last Saturday, while Trump was having his little parade, millions of people hit the streets, and not just in big cities. I mean, small towns that voted for Trump had major showings. And it really feels like there's an energy here. And I don't know where that energy goes. It's very early to tell. But there is real anger here. And among people that aren't used to hitting the streets, you have resistance libs who are ready to march and are marching. And you know, it's encouraging.
And in terms of the kind of, it seems like, yes, these men in masks are alarming communities. They're disappearing people. It seems unclear how many people have actually been taken, what's become of them. How have the protests and the various other forms of resistance, do you think, affected this campaign? Like, how effective is the resistance to these maneuvers thus far?
I mean, I think it depends on your perspective. From one angle, not at all. I mean, it hasn't stopped the deportation. It hasn't really stopped ICE from doing what it's doing. There have been instances of community defense getting ICE to back off, to run away. And that, I think, is very effective. It not only does it help protect people in your community, but if you get it on video, it makes them look like the cowards they are. And I think that's hugely, hugely helpful. And by that metric, the massive No Kings Day protests and things like that aren't effective because they aren't directly stopping ICE. What I think though, and what I think some people are overlooking, is that they are very effective in activating people. It's a big ask to ask somebody's first political event, first time going out in the streets, to be a de-arrest. That most people are not going to be willing to do that their first time out, flat out. These protests are a good way for people who maybe never thought of themselves as protesters to get out there with their signs, meet like-minded people, get used to the idea of getting out on the street. And in the case of LA, witnessing firsthand what police violence looks like, because it's one thing to hear about it, and it's another thing to experience it. I think people are loath to believe that cops will simply open up with rubber bullets and pellet guns and tear gas on protesters that aren't doing anything. But we've seen that in LA, and the people on the ground have seen that. And this is not a fight that's going to be over soon. I mean, what's happening here, I don't know when it ends. I think years is optimistic. But I think I view these protests as things that are activating people. And this is the beginning. This is the prologue. And I think that if you look at these protests as well, they're not immediately pushing back in a big way. Like, yeah, that's true. But this was never going to be a short fight. This is a long fight. And I see these protests as hugely encouraging.
Laura, just before we started recording, Trump announced that they'd begun bombing Iran, which I guess is the beginning, the culmination of a dream for many conservatives in the United States. But how is the prospect of a world war fracturing the MAGA coalition?
Oh, magnificently. I've been very much enjoying that part. It is a very bad cloud and a very small silver lining, but it's not nothing. There's a whole section of the Republican Party, and I've just been flat out calling them National Socialists, because at this point, what they really do want is a state that is more or less a welfare state, but only for the people that they believe deserve it, white, male, American, whatever. Anyway, these people are genuinely anti-interventionist, at least when it comes to wars in the Middle East. Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, Charlie Kirk to some extent, Josh Hawley, beside themselves, furious, enraged. And the people who support this war, the cultists who believe that we need war in Israel to usher in the end times, and the Zionists and the Israeli lobby, they are all very excited about war in Iran. And it's been really fun to listen to their podcasts. Almost all of them open with, it's all a myth, there is no MAGA fracturing, everything's fine. And then they just go on to say that the people who oppose them aren't real MAGA, and like, they're traitors. And it's great. It's really fantastic. I mean, it'll be interesting to see just how many people voted for Trump because they hate the forever wars. I don't think it's an insignificant number. This gives a boost to the protests and fractures his base. And what a bad move. What a magnificently terrible choice.
And Laura, how have the Democrats responded to this, I guess, both Trump's recent policies and also the split within the MAGA coalition, because it would seem to present some kind of political opportunity?
It would. I think responding is a really strong word for anything the Democratic Party is doing right now. There are individual Democrats who are killing it. But yeah, no, unfortunately, it would appear that what they're doing is nothing. Nothing at all. Well, they do appear to be attacking New York mayoral candidate Zoran Mondami. They seem to be doing that a lot. That seems to be their main priority right now. But as to actually exploiting any of the weaknesses of MAGA, that doesn't seem to be a priority for them at all. It's very frustrating. I do take a lot of hope from the mayoral race in New York City. And I know this city can sometimes be very full of itself and think that everything that happens here matters way more than it does. But this one does, I think, because this is a Democratic Socialist of America candidate who came up with zero name recognition. He started out polling like 2%, and he has a real chance of winning. And this matters for more than New York, because I think this shows that the Democratic Party establishment, which is doing nothing, can be challenged effectively. And if it can happen in America's biggest city, it can happen elsewhere in America too, because it has to. Because the Democrats are just, they're basically, it feels like they're just the token party at this point, more than they've ever been. Just the kind of mealy-mouthed, oh, this is bad, LOL, here's a taco truck, please send us $27. It's untenable. They're worse than useless.
Laura, perhaps as a New Yorker, you could explain to us, Cuomo is still in it. How?
I don't know. This man who resigned in disgrace after extremely credible and multiple sexual harassment allegations, who was indicated in a plot to downplay COVID numbers in ways that got people at nursing homes killed. This absolute, who hasn't lived in New York City for 30 years, is somehow still in the lead by most, but not all polls. I don't know. I think it really speaks to the fear that establishment Democrats have, that big business has, that the moneyed interests have in keeping someone like Zorin far away from the levers of power. They'll do whatever it takes. They'll do whatever they have to do to keep one of their boys in, even if one of their boys is just abhorrent and completely unelectable and unlikable. They're going to do their best. And I mean, we'll see. Tuesday is when the election happens. It'll probably take about a week with ranked choice voting to see who actually won. But my God, if we get Cuomo, it just, it's depressing to think that it's even a possibility.
Laura, I noticed Zuckerberg has recently donned some Oakleys in order to impress the masses. But where are the tech bros generally in regards to the Republicans and the Democrats and the Trump kind of warmongering?
That's a great question. So big tech tends to be a little bit inscrutable. They, I mean, obviously they jumped on the Trump bandwagon late, but they, I have to imagine they're excited because, of course, war is a great, great opportunity for tech. The tech bros, which like I would call like Peter Thiel, PayPal Mafia, Palantir, Musk somehow, even though he's also definitely big tech as well. They're, I think, over the moon. I still can't believe this is real, but executives from Palantir and OpenAI and a couple other companies like it have enlisted in the military, or they've sworn into the military as lieutenant colonels, which is a rank that a lot of officers never achieve in 20 years of service. They've just signed in at that rank. They don't have to go to basic training. They just get, I suppose this is a paid commission situation, which of course works out super well for all the armies that have ever tried that. But I do think it's indicative of a really quite, I mean, almost a marriage alliance between tech pros and the military. I think they're super stoked. I'm sure Palantir is beside themselves about all of this.
Yeah. Well, besides anything else, they can get that military discount at Starbucks.
There it is. God.
You recently wrote an article for The Nation about things going on in Idaho, specifically in the privatization of the education sector. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Idaho Republicans have been up to?
Oh, boy. So absolutely. Idaho is, there are a few places in America that I think are really kind of test labs for the Republicans for what's going to roll out elsewhere. Florida being a really obvious one. Tennessee is another. And Idaho is a third one that I think people kind of don't look at because it's a very large state geographically, very small population. It's just kind of in the Pacific Northwest, gets mixed up with Ohio a lot. But that state has, since about the 1960s, been the subject of a very deliberate campaign to change it from what it used to be, which was Union Blue, to what it is now, which is just deepest, deepest red. The Aryan Nations set up their headquarters there. Ruby Ridge happened there. It is a place where extremists have traveled, along with just extremely radical Republicans. And of course, increasingly, that's just the same picture. But these elements have taken over the Republican Party in what I have to admit is a very clever way. They simply had their fanatics run for extremely minor partisan positions within the Republican Party called a precinct committee person or a precinct captain, which is basically just for every precinct that votes, the captain is responsible for getting out the vote and making sure things go well and sometimes fundraising. They also get to vote on the party platform and they get to vote on higher offices within the Republican Party. So if you get a majority, which they have, that means that they now have control over the Idaho Republican Party platform, which is why the Idaho Republican Party platform includes things like going back on the gold standards and outlawing IVF and assorted just Christo-fascist horse BS. It's horrible. One of the things that they seem to be trying to do very hard is going after education, which is, of course, something that fascists all over the world really enjoy doing. But they are, it's just generally a very underfunded education system. Specifically, the article I wrote about was about North Idaho College, which is a small community college. One of the only one that's really accessible to an entire region of this very large and very sparsely populated state, which they essentially got some of their goons elected to the board of trustees, who then just began to make trouble. They just made things so dysfunctional and wasted so much money and got the school embroiled in so many lawsuits that the accreditation board basically went through all of the steps and was inches away from pulling their accreditation, period. And that would have been a complete catastrophe for the whole region. That is, most people in that area have been to North Idaho College. Whether they wanted to take it private or simply eliminate it was up for debate. That has, since the article was written, luckily, there was an election a few weeks after it came out, and the people of Idaho gave them the boot, and they are now on the path to recovery. And it turned out to be a really beautiful story, but it didn't necessarily, it wasn't always going to, it was real touch and go there for a second.
And it also seemed like, unfortunately, the solution to that problem is you need to get people to do really boring jobs.
Yes. Yes, it's horrible. They genuinely weaponized boredom. It's incredible. I mean, I think we see this a lot, actually. I think that's the school board moms that we had out here. This was another, like, who wants to go to a school board meeting? I certainly don't. Boring as heck, or it used to be. And yeah, I mean, it is. It's just, if people who aren't paying attention and don't want to do these boring volunteer jobs, yeah, unfortunately, this is also why, like, voting is not enough. Voting is not enough. Voting is not enough. Voting can be a good small tool in the arsenal of things that we do, especially in hyperlocal elections. Because national, you know, you have less of an impact nationally, but in a local election, these things can be decided by tens. So I do hope that people will take this away and along with all the other things that need to be done, in addition to those things, take a couple hours to vote in local elections.
Laura, outside of Idaho, the higher education system has been under some pressure from the Trump regime, including very notable institutions like Columbia and Harvard and so on. How is that kind of attack upon higher education progressing in your view? And how do you think that this kind of war that's developing or an accelerated role for the US in war on the Middle East will impact upon, say, the student movement?
That's a great question. Both of those are great questions. So the Trump's effort to mess with Columbia and Harvard has stalled out in the courts somewhat at this time. His latest thing is trying to take away Harvard's ability to accept international students, which is a huge deal because international students tend to pay full price. It's how Harvard subsidizes a lot of their research and how Harvard is able to do the scholarships that they do. And it's also how America attacks top-notch talent. And losing that would, I think, be bad for this country, for better or for worse. But that is stalled out in the courts at the moment. I think that's going to continue. I think it's already with the police riots in LA and now war, apparently, and just all the other BS that's happening that has been kind of pushed off of the headlines, but it is still very much going on. And I do think that, I mean, they understand that statistically speaking, people who go to college tend to be more progressive and they would like that to stop. They understand the importance of indoctrination and they would like to be able to do that. And this is the attacks on all levels of education from elementary school, taking books about LGBT people out to colleges and universities, kneecapping their ability to do research, scientific research, kneecapping their ability to get funding for that research is all and absolutely an attack on the machine that keeps people educated and interested in things like social safety nets and understanding that everybody is human, even people you maybe haven't met yet or who speak different languages. It's one of those things that I think is going to have more of a long-term effect than a short-term one. There will be some very dramatic short-term effects if this goes through, but really, this is a long-term project to destroy American education and replace it with indoctrination. Some of the fellows that are involved in the Idaho project from the Claremont Institute have written some real interesting things, and you'll recognize some of this, the idea of school that emphasizes repetition and physical fitness above all other things. I mean, it really is. You could just copy-paste a description of schooling in Nazi Germany, and it would be identical. They're very open about what they want to do with it.
Laura, one small victory that's been won recently, I suppose, or note of hope, is the release of Mahmoud Khalil, one of many who've been disappeared, kidnapped by the regime on spurious grounds. Do you think that this may be read as possibly the courts beginning to have an effect and popular resistance beginning to have an effect upon Trump's policy in this regard?
I mean, it's a huge victory, I think, on certainly for Khalil and for justice and for basic morality and for the rule of law, obviously, just the way that the idea that our country is in a place of laws and not men, it's huge. And there have been small victories like this all along. And it goes somewhat underreported. And I don't even think that's necessarily the worst thing, because the bad things do need attention. The courts have not done a perfect job or even a great job but they've done an okay job in limited circumstances where the Supreme Court isn't involved. And this is another instance of that. This is not an original thought, but somebody, I don't remember who on social media put this, I think, really well, that the horror of these disappearances is the idea that you are now no place, that you are gone and cannot be retrieved, that you'd better toe the line or you too will simply vanish. And every time somebody comes back from a disappearance, it erodes that fear. And I think that is the most important thing about this. They wanted Khalil to disappear, and he didn't. He's back with his wife. And I'm so thankful, just as a human being and as a citizen of this incredibly disappointing country, I'm so grateful that it happened. And I do hope that it can be a source of inspiration for further resistance. I don't think this is a turning point in the courts. I'm afraid. I think the courts are doing a decent job of slowing what's happening. I don't know how long they're going to be able to do that. And I don't know with the Supreme Court we have, if that will ultimately be successful at all.
Well, Laura, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to find you online, you are on Blue Sky, Laura Jadid, as well as having a newsletter at bannedinyourstate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, Andy, that is our program, but just a reminder that you still have a little bit of time to donate to the 3CR Radiothon. You can go to 3cr.org.au/donate and make sure you tell them it's for Yeah Nah Pasaran, and we will catch you next week.
We will.
3CR Radiothon 2025. Your station, your voice.
For the month of June, we're asking listeners to donate to the station to help keep us going. We rely on the generous donations of the community to survive. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate and show your support for community-owned and community-run media.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are. At home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.